I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The asset value of whiteness. Two new reports look at wealth inequality in Baltimore and beyond. Nationally, blacks have a median household income that's only 60% of that of whites. African Americans are less likely to own their homes, and when they do, the houses are worth less than those of whites. What will it take to turn this around? The go-to solutions? Obtaining an education, two-parent households. Well, they don't always translate into making the field more level. Amy Traub is the author of a study that looks at the national landscape. Diedrich Asante Mohammed wrote The Racial Wealth Divide in Baltimore. They join me along with Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities to talk about the roots and reasons behind wealth inequality. That's ahead on Midday, right after these headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. Thanks so much to everybody who has made a pledge in this, our spring membership campaign. We very, very much appreciate it. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we're going to have a conversation about the racial wealth gap and why it persists. Nationally, blacks have a median household income that's 60% of that of whites. And here in Baltimore, that number is even worse. It's at 54%. That's according to a report from the nonprofit Corporation for Enterprise Development. For millions of people, home ownership is the key to building wealth. African Americans and Latinos are less likely to own their own homes, and when they do, because of years of redlining in communities of color, they're valued a lot lower than houses in traditionally white communities. Inevitably, whenever conversations about inequality come up, observers from conservative scholars to even folks like former President Barack Obama point to personal responsibility as a cause of people doing well or not economically. But the data shows that personal motivation and hard work does not, by a long shot, explain the persistent imbalance between the accumulated wealth of African Americans and whites. A new report from the public policy think tank Demos found that often go-to solutions to address economic inequality aren't nearly as effective as you might think. For example, African Americans and Latinos are less likely to have graduated from high school or college, but when they do, their wealth is equivalent to white high school dropouts. And what about single-parent African American families? The median white single parent has more than two times the wealth of the median black two-parent household. So what's behind the racial wealth gap, and what can be done to close it? Diedrich Asante Mohammed joins me in the studio. He's the senior fellow for the Racial Wealth Divide at CFED, the Corporation for Economic Development. He's the author of a report that looks at the racial wealth divide here in Baltimore. He also writes a column about race and inequality for the Huffington Post. It's good to meet you, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Adar Ayira is Director of Programs at Associate Black Charities. She also serves on the advisory board of Baltimore Racial Justice Action, and she's here in Studio A. Adar, always a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you.
Amy Traub is on the line with us from New York. She's the Associate Director of Policy and Research for Demos, a public policy organization that does research to inform public policy that reduces political and economic inequality. She is the lead author of their latest report, The Asset Value of Whiteness, Understanding the Racial Wealth Gap. Ms. Traub, thank you for your time as well.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
So, Ms. Traub, let me start with you. When one takes a look at one's wealth and whatever accumulated money or valued stuff that folks might have, you look, say, well, maybe we have a house and, you know, the mortgage might be paid off eventually, and maybe we've got a car and the car payments are, you know, coming to a close. Pretty soon we'll own that and whatever it is we have in the bank. But most white people certainly probably don't think that their whiteness, their basic whiteness, is also an asset that really helps them in a variety of subtle ways. That's what this report is about. In what way is whiteness an asset when it comes to wealth?
Well, wealth is primarily handed down across generations. You did a great job. I loved it, your introduction, talking about some of the history and public policy that led to the building of the American middle class and the expansion of wealth in this country. In the years after World War II, we had public policies like the GI Bill that primarily helped white veterans attend college and purchase homes with guaranteed mortgages. And those really built the foundations of the American middle class, which is great. We love the middle class. But it was built in ways that largely excluded people of color through policies like redlining and segregation. And that was a generation or two ago, maybe more if you're a young person. But wealth is handed down across generations. And so the outcomes of those exclusionary policies are still with us today. And they're reinforced by ostensibly colorblind policies and practices that are still in effect today. And so that's why benefits that predominantly went to white households a generation or two ago continue to show up in our bank accounts and our wallets today.
And Diedrich Asante-Mohammed, you looked at Baltimore specifically. Is Baltimore typical of other cities across the country? Is this something that's at all unique to Baltimore?
Well, racial wealth inequality is definitely not unique to Baltimore. Racial wealth inequality is sadly the norm across the country. And now we have a project, Building High Impact Nonprofits of Color, where we're focused in four cities, Baltimore, New Orleans, Miami, and Chicago. And so we did these racial wealth divide data profiles in each city. Now, interestingly enough, Baltimore actually has less racial inequality than those other cities. Baltimore's racial inequality is pretty normal compared to what it is across the country. But we've seen a lot of cities like Miami, New Orleans, that actually the racial wealth divide, which is so bad nationally, is even worse at cities.
Are you using the terms racial inequality and racial wealth divides synonymously there? Or I just want to make sure I understand what you mean by if Baltimore has less racial inequality, what does that mean?
Sure. Less. They're not synonymous, but I am talking about the same thing in this instance where racial economic inequality is worse, say, in Miami, where in Baltimore, the African-Americans have about 54% of the income of whites. But in Miami, African-Americans only have 30% of the income of whites. In Chicago, African-Americans have 43% of the income of whites. In New Orleans, 40% of the income of whites. And so and what you see is that in a lot of these cities that have historically been black, you have and oftentimes in Baltimore would be the case that worked in the manufacturing area, you have more higher income people who had come in. And the whites in these cities actually make much more than they do nationwide, right? The median income for whites in Miami is like $71,000, while the median income for whites across the country is more like $60,000. So that's where you see that racial income inequality, an aspect of racial economic inequality, is even worse in some of these other cities. And we can get into this later, but I think actually Baltimore is uniquely situated to address these issues if the city is really willing to dive into this problem.
And Adar Ayer, these are problems that are longstanding, as Amy Traub mentioned. This is a generational thing. Some of these policies, like redlining, for example, emanate from the federal government. I mean, it's not necessarily, the bank around the corner in the white neighborhood in Baltimore that's doing it. These are directives that came down from Washington. Because these problems are so longstanding, they cross generations, and they're coming from places that we don't have direct connection to. It's not like we can go to the mayor's office and fix this immediately. What do you see the way forward? How do you see the way forward?
Well, a lot of those policies did emanate and do emanate from the federal government, but there is a lot that we can do locally because wealth is also built and opportunities for wealth are built by investments. Where are we investing? In what neighborhoods? How are loans being distributed to emerging entrepreneurs? What are the barriers along the way that keeps those loans from emerging black businessmen, emerging businessmen and women of other colors? These are the types of decisions that we as a city have control over. And we do not make those decisions or those policies with a racial equity lens. If we just even asked ourselves, is there a disproportionate benefit for some communities? Is that disproportionate benefit racialized? Then we would be able to create local policies that are much fairer and that can help enable wealth building in our marginalized communities.
And Amy Traub, what struck me about reading your report that's looking at the national scene is that a couple of the things that, that people sort of instinctively point to as solutions long term are education, number one, and then the two-parent household, number two. These are things you hear all the time, both from conservatives and people on the left side of the ledger. But you found, for example, that these things don't begin to really substantially address the problems of wealth inequality. Talk about education in particular. What is the difference between people who are educated, you know, post high school with a little bit or all of college versus people who drop out of high school divided along racial lines?
Certainly. So we found that, that attending college does not close the racial wealth gap. And I want to be very clear that that doesn't mean that attending college and graduating college won't improve an individual's life and income, because often it will. And I also don't want to gloss over all of the barriers that are faced in getting a college education, and particularly by people of color. But what we found is that a college education really is not sufficient on the level of our entire society to address this really deeply rooted societal problem. And so we found that to gain wealth that's comparable to white high school dropouts, Black and Latino students need to not only complete high school, so not only match them in achievement, but also attend college. And so we're seeing here that higher education is valuable. But when it comes to wealth, and when it comes to wealth for big groups of people society-wide at the median, white privilege is equally, if not more valuable than a college education.
And Deidre Cassante-Mohammed, when some folks hear that, they mm-hmm. think, you know, I know, and these are white folks I'm talking mm-hmm. about, I know all sorts of companies that are dying to hire people of color. They want to make their workforces more diverse. They want to make their communities more diverse. They're looking for people who are qualified. So how could it possibly be that if there are candidates, you know, of color who got a college education, statistically, nationally, they're actually doing only as well as people, white people who dropped out of high school?
Yeah.
It just seems like that doesn't compute on a certain level.
Well, there's, you know, I think several things in that statement. One, you know, people have to understand that, and, you know, I went to a very, I'm African-American, went to elite white school, college, and had a lot of friends who came out making six-figure salaries. And so you're making, so I have some friends making some high income, but that doesn't immediately translate into wealth. Because if, you know, a lot of my white friends from that school, they might have got a little bit of help for their down payment for their first house or for their wedding, and probably didn't have college debt. But my African-American friends did have college debt, and not only paid for all of their own down payment, was probably helping their aunt with their rent. So you don't have, even though you're making, in some cases, equal income, you don't get the same type of returns on that income, because a challenge of racial economic inequality is not that individuals have you know, little wealth. It's if they're from households and whole communities that are in asset poverty. So as you come forward a little bit, you're still using a lot of that to help support those around you. So, and so even goodwill on the corporate side's not automatically going to change that. Though I would challenge, I've done some reports on diversity hiring, and I think there's a lot more corporations could do if they're truly interested in broadening their employee portfolio, particularly at the higher levels.
Sure. Well, there's, I don't think, any doubt about that. But Adar, Ayira, this notion of personal responsibility, personal mm-hmm. accountability, here just the other day, yesterday, I guess, it's Jason Chaffetz, a leading Republican in Congress, made a comment that, you know, when it comes to health care coverage, people got to make the decision to buy health care instead of that new iPhone. So they're talking about these personal choices that may affect people's accessibility, which is the new buzzword that the Republicans are using in relation to health care. And even President Obama, who was chided by several black intellectuals and leaders. I mean, I had Michael Eric Dyson on the show a few weeks ago, and he's not kind to the president. I mean, he's a supporter mm-hmm. of Mr. Obama, but was not kind when the president tended to, you know, say to folks, hey, look, you know, pull your pants up and get yourself together. How does that, in your work at Associated Black Charities, mm-hmm. how does that feel on the ground? What are you hearing and what are you seeing?
So there are so many different things to this. So, but going back to the President Obama quote, what I found really interesting was that he was talking to Morehouse soon-to-be graduates when he said that.
Kids graduating from one of the finest HBCUs in the
country. Exactly.
Yeah,
and one of the, not only one of the finest HBCUs, but one of the finest schools in the country. And he said that. So there is always political motivation and gain that is a very low-hanging fruit to chastise the Black community. It also affirms and promotes a certain narrative that it is only personal responsibility that is standing in the way of some communities advancing. We know that that personal narrative is not true. We know from the work of Amy, from the work of Dietrich, that is not a true narrative, yet we hang to it. Interestingly enough, when we talk about personal responsibility, we only talk about that in terms of communities of color. We do not talk about that in terms of other communities where we give individuals second, third, and fourth chances. And when we talk about individuals, such as another former president who was in his 40s when he was doing something that he wasn't supposed to do in terms of pot, right, or some drug. But then we, in Black communities, we say that that 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11-year-old children are adults who should have taken personal responsibility. So when we look at society and the messages that are received, personal responsibility is only discussed when you're talking about marginalized people. We don't discuss it for Congress people who are getting insurance without having to choose between their insurance and an iPhone.
Yeah, and I'm interested. I'd like to see the data on what percentage of people with iPhones don't have health insurance. I mean, I think that's just one of those people make up things and say it and then actually respond to it. But where's the data behind that?
That's a great researcher question. And we will come back to that and many more questions. Dietrich Asante Mohammed is a senior fellow for the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative for the Corporation for Economic Development. Amy Traub is the Associate Director of Policy and Research for Demos. She's the lead author of their recent report, The Asset Value of Whiteness, Understanding the Racial Wealth Gap. A. Adar Aira is Director of Programs at Associated Black Charities here in Baltimore, and she serves on the advisory board of Baltimore Racial Justice Action. And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation with the author Mohsen Hamid about his new novel, Exit West. It's a love story set against the backdrop of the global refugee crisis. It's a terrific read, and it couldn't be more timely. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review The White Snake at Baltimore Center Stage. If you're just joining us today on this International Women's Day, we're talking about the racial wealth divide and why it persists here in Baltimore and across the country. It's an issue that, of course, affects a lot of women and affects many, many people of color. I'm joined in the studio by Dietrich Asante Mohammed. He's the senior fellow of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative for the nonprofit Corporation for Enterprise Development, or CFED. CFED has just released a report that looks at the racial wealth divide right here in Baltimore. The report was funded by J.P. Morgan Chase. Adar Aira is also here in the studio. She's the Director of Programs for the Associated Black Charities and serves on the advisory board of Baltimore Racial Justice Action. And Amy Traub joins us on the line from New York. She's the Associate Director of Policy and Research for a think tank called Demos, and she's the lead author of their recent report entitled The Asset Value of Whiteness, Understanding the Racial Wealth Gap. We'd love to hear from you and have you be part of our conversation here on Midday. It's a different phone number to be part of the Midday conversation. If you want to make a pledge, of course, we'll never turn that down. That number one more time is 410-235-1395. If you want to be part of our conversation about the racial wealth divide, call 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email at midday@wipr.org. And if you want to drop us a tweet, we're at Midday Tom Hall. So, Amy Traub, let's talk about another one of the solutions, so-called, that folks point to when they consider this issue, and that's the two-parent household. We're told over and over again that one of the problems in the African-American community, at least here in Baltimore and in many other places, is that, you know, so many kids are growing up with just one parent at home, and that's a real problem. And that if you're married or if you've got two parents, two guardians in the house, that's automatically gonna give you a leg up. What did you find when you looked into that particular aspect of this?
Well, it's definitely the case that raising children is expensive. I've got two of them myself. I know it. The high cost of childcare and the difficulty supporting a family on a single income makes it particularly difficult for single parents to get by, much less build wealth. And we do find that single-parent households have higher poverty rates and lower wealth than two-parent households. But despite all of that, raising children in a two-parent household is not enough to overcome racial disparities in wealth. Our analysis was of data from the Survey of Consumer Finances, and we found that the median white single parent still has 2.2 times more wealth than the median black two-parent household. And again, that goes back to this generational wealth, and it just trumps family structure. And we're finding here that family structure really is not driving racial inequity, and racial inequality is persisting regardless of family structure.
And, you know, I find it interesting that people are searching so hard to try to figure out, well, why are blacks not doing that well, when it's, I mean, fairly obvious that this country has a long history of racial inequality and contemporary racial inequality and the way people are treated. And I think people are trying to, you know, find other ways to talk about it, but we have to deal with those issues. And you know, so it's not a coincidence that African Americans and Native Americans are on the worst aspects, on the worst side of racial wealth inequality. Latinos aren't doing as well as either. So it's not hard. It's people are scared to talk about racial inequality as it relates to these concrete things. And, you know, the reports like this, like the one from Demos, is highlighting that we have to deal with these larger issues of racial inequality if we're going to. And I always like to say the core of racial inequality is racial economic inequality. So we can't deal with racial inequality either by just having meetings and getting to know people and holding hands. We have to actually invest. The white middle class didn't just happen. They were invested in, as Amy's reports put forward, as our reports have put forward. We have to put that investment in people of color, and the country has never shown a willingness to do that.
Yeah, I mean, and Daria, you work in this field directly. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that is really holding the country back from really addressing the issues is the propensity to stick with this national narrative, right? Pretending that the history and the impact of that history has not happened, and that everybody can pull themselves up by the bootstrap, all of the mythology that we tell ourselves. Because if we really talked about what has happened in this country, that came and the results of policy, the results of our cultural perspective, the results of our societal inclinations, then we would have to just ditch the narrative that we have had for 400 or more years about American exceptionalism, about everybody being able to work hard and everybody having a fair break and there being a level playing field. And quite frankly, people have not and still are not in large measure ready to do that. And until we do, then people will never be able to see what is or accept what is really going on in the country in terms of policies and procedures that hold groups of people back. We'll also have to accept the notion that there is group identity and always has been in America. And the primary group identity, the group identity with which all other groups have been measured against, has been white.
L gets in touch with us on the WYPR Facebook page. She says, I'm a single parent who has sole custody of my child. I have to drive a parent and disabled brother to places and help my daughter on average an hour and a half every night with her homework. I don't make that much money. Who can't really rely on my only parent to help me with my child? So she has an only parent, evidently, and she says, I do have a BS. So she's got a bachelor's degree. I wondered, Deidre Santi Mohammed, does it all come down to, when you talk about investment, the investment that was made through things like the GI Bill and other things, does it come down to affirmative action or reparations or you know, some sort of lending, you know, bank lending policies that favor people of color over other groups in certain instances? I mean, what is the remedy that, as you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're asking for a kind of reverse redlining per se, or this idea that we only invest in people of color. If there was, you know, if there was honest investment into developing a new American middle class, we just have to make sure that for the first time that people of color are actually included equally, and that we really are looking at making those who who are low wealth into median wealth and create a middle class. There's never been that investment, you know, and there are, of course, whites who are in asset poverty. As the report that we put forward shows in Baltimore, 32% of whites are in asset poverty. It's just 67 and 65% of blacks and Latinos are in asset poverty. So we're saying we need for the first time this type of investment that will include all of Americans. And it's really important as the country becomes majority minority, because it's no longer just a small group over here or in Baltimore, 63% of the population that's suffering. It's going to be the majority of the entire country. And how is that going to affect the American economy when the majority of America is no longer truly middle class?
It's interesting that the presidential campaign, the rhetoric, and certainly the post-campaign, post-election analysis included this notion of the forgotten middle class as being white.
Right.
I mean, the right. Trump voter, no one thought of an unemployed black steelworker mm-hmm. or a black coal miner as a Trump mm-hmm. voter. They thought of white people in general. As you say, Adara, being the sort of the default mm-hmm. Is just time and again white. We're going to take a quick break in just a second. But before we do, let's go to the phones. Alana in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air.
Okay, I have a question as a mid-30s black single professional. So in terms of saving for retirement, is it better to aim for maybe a higher income neighborhood in order to get the benefits of prices going up over time? Or maybe live in a neighborhood where there's more people who look like you and focus on investing elsewhere for retirement?
So this is in relation to home ownership, I'm assuming you're talking about?
Yes.
I mean, again, I wouldn't give you clear financial advice when I don't know your situation that well. But I will say generally, I mean, it is, home ownership is the number one source of wealth for most Americans. And African-Americans, Latinos only have about 43% of our homeowners, while whites are 70%. So it is true that home ownership, is a very helpful tool in building up wealth over the long term. But it's also true that a house in a black neighborhood or Latino neighborhood is not going to be valued the same way it is in a white neighborhood. So, I mean, people have to, for themselves, figure out, what type of communities they want to live in, what's important for them, who's around them. For me, it's important to have a strong African-American population in where I live. But, home ownership is important, and I think as long as it's sustainable and you're going to be there for years, you are going to be able to develop some assets and wealth on that. But it's just that alone can't be your retirement.
Well, it's interesting. We got to take a break. I want to come back and talk about it, but it's striking that for a lot of white listeners, folks need to be reminded that here's, a young professional woman in her 30s, African-American, and she's got this extra layer of stuff to think about when she talks about investing. White people just don't have that. We will talk more about that. Diedrich Asante-Muhammad is the Senior Fellow for the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative. He's the author of a report that looks at the racial wealth divide right here in Baltimore. Amy Traub's on the line from New York. She's the lead author of The Asset Value of Whiteness, Understanding the Racial Wealth Gap. Adar Ayer is Director of Programs at Associated Black Charities, and she serves on the Advisory Board of Baltimore Racial Justice Action. And welcome back. It's Midday here on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us this afternoon. Amy Traub is here as well. She's on the line from New York. She's the Associate Director of Policy and Research for the public policy advocacy organization called DEMOS. She's the lead author of their recent report, The Asset Value of Whiteness, Understanding the Racial Wealth Gap. Diedrich Asante-Muhammad is the Senior Fellow for the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative. He's the author of a report that looks at the racial wealth divide right here in Baltimore. And Adar Ayera is the Director of Programs at Associated Black Charities. She serves on the Advisory Board of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action. By the way, we've got links to copies of both of these reports on our website, wipr.org/midday. If you want to join our conversation, it's a different phone number than the one that we're using to make a pledge in our spring membership campaign. That number, again, 410-235-1395. If you want to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780 to be on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday Tom Hall. So, Adar, you do with your, in your work with Baltimore Racial Justice Action, you do racial sensitivity training, you do, you work with people of all races about cross-cultural understanding, that kind of stuff. But Deidre Kassani Mohammed makes an interesting point that this racial wealth divide that we're talking about, this is an economic thing that's a, it's a 30,000-foot view, not this individual thing, oh, okay, I'm a white guy with a black friend or something like that. It's more than just interpersonal communication, isn't it?
So let me share that at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, we talk about these issues from a structural perspective, not just from an interpersonal, somebody called me a name or I'm insensitive perspective. We understand that the issues are structural and that they have an impact on every single solitary aspect of society, including the 30-some professional who called in wondering where she should buy a home. We swim in these issues. And one thing that we're taught as a society is to see issues of racism as individual issues. And that keeps our eye off of the ways in which they are generational, in which they are deliberately connected to policy and to practices and to culture of our society. That's what we address in BRJA.
Yeah. Carol Alexander, who's been on our program, she's a professor at Emory University in the African-American Studies Department, and she calls it the veil of racial innocence that white people have because they think of racists as the Ku Klux Klan or, you know, these extremists, you know, Dylan Roof, you know, those kinds of people, instead of the sort of the sometimes the people call them the microaggressions, you know, that people encounter, people of color encounter every day. I mean, but this there is always some relationship, Diedrich, between the interpersonal and the macro, is there?
Sure. No. Yeah. There is some, but again, you know, there's too much. We all watch too many movies where there's a good guy and there's a bad guy. Not that most people do good and bad things, you know, and that, you know, there has been real bad things that's happened as it relates to racial inequality. But there's small things that we do every day that keeps maintain this, where people where, you know, whites generally don't live in neighborhoods with over a certain amount of African-Americans in it, which brings property downs and has structural forces behind it, which then makes black neighborhoods not have the same value. One thing I'll throw out to the person who called about where she should buy a home, I will say if you can find a home that you like and that you want to stay in for the next 10 to 20 years and it's cheaper, yeah, I would go for that, because you take that extra money that you're saving on your mortgage and you put it in a 401k or an index fund, you're going to get a better return on an index fund than you are in your home appreciation. So that's the main thing you're thinking about. Yeah, don't buy as a big investment tool. You know, but you also should think about, do you want to have kids? Because home isn't just what dollars you get back, but what type of community you're living in. Are you going to have a good public school system there that can help you? Because it's usually better to stay in a house for a long time than it is to move every 4 years. You don't get the same type of return. So that's a little of the best I can do advice on that.
Yeah, and Amy Traub, let me relate to you an email we've gotten from James in Baltimore. He says, clearly we understand that urban poverty is disproportionately black, while white suburban and urban wealth far outpaces black wealth. But what does the data say about rural whites in impoverished areas, for example, and their ability to amass wealth without removing themselves from their communities and integrating themselves into suburban communities? Is there evidence that shows that whiteness in poor areas is intrinsically wealthier and on an upward swing? That's an interesting question. Amy, did you look at that at all?
It is an interesting question, and what we looked at in this study really was a focus on the median household, so the median black household, Latino household, white household, which certainly includes very low-wealth white communities as well, low-wealth black communities, but really we are focused on the median household here to see if personal behaviors change the median. And we've looked also at how public policy can change the median. And so you know, certainly there needs to be a focus on both in terms of policy and in terms of analysis that really drills down on the effects of policy on low-wealth white communities as well. But that was not our focus here in this study.
And the other thing is, another way to look at this is that whiteness in itself is currency in America.
Exactly.
And so it's not just about your wealth. It's not just about your income. Those two things are extremely important. But you cannot discount the currency of whiteness. That currency can be mitigated depending on whether you are cisgender, depending on whether you are male or female, depending on whether you are disabled, depending on a variety of factors. But regardless of how whiteness is mitigated in a whiteness hierarchy, whiteness in this society is still currency.
And there is a report called Umbrellas Don't Make It Rain, which does look at blacks and whites with different income quintiles. And it's true that whites, low-income whites, have more wealth than low-income blacks, and high-income whites have more wealth than high-income blacks. So I haven't seen the study necessarily rural poor, but I have seen nationally, when you say not doing that well economically, oftentimes people look at that income. But again, poor whites have a lot more wealth than poor blacks, and oftentimes more wealth than median-income blacks.
And in rural areas, that may include factors like owning a home and owning land.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Is it then, Diedrich, does it come down to, if as Adar says, and it's absolutely true, that whiteness itself is a currency, then what's the aspiration for a middle-class African-American person? Is it to be white, or is it to be separate but equal, to coin the old phrase? I mean, it does present a dilemma, does it not, in terms of aspirationally where people, what is the measure of success?
I mean, I think, and I'll let Dara answer that more, but it is true. I mean, if society set up where what is norm and what is right is whiteness, then in some ways we're all trying to, get to this level that, and again, the whiteness isn't just you being white. It also whiteness came from racial exclusion and from taking assets from other communities and concentrating in a separate community. And that's not something anyone should aspire to, but.
And this is the interesting question, because the question is even larger than that. It is a question of whether we as a country are satisfied with whiteness being currency. If we as a country are saying that we strive to be just, that we strive to be fair, that we strive to be a model, then are we satisfied with a whiteness as currency perspective? Is that what we're going to continue to promote, knowing how it denigrates and how it disadvantages the people who are not white in this society? So if we feel that we can say that we are a just nation while knowing that we're throwing everybody else under the bus, that is the question for our country.
The bar simply has to be changed.
Yes, yeah. It does.
Well, we're going to give William in his email the last word today here on Midday. He says, much of your white audience doesn't believe the things that caused this disparity actually occurred. They've been and continue to be taught a whitewashed version of American history. That is certainly a part of this whole discussion. I appreciate all of you being here. Amy Traub, Adar Ayer, and Diedrich Asante-Mohammed, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Diedrich Asante-Mohammed is the Senior Fellow for the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative for the Nonprofit Corporation for Enterprise Development. He's the author of a report that looks at the racial wealth divide right here in Baltimore, and he also writes a column about race and inequality for the Huffington Post. A. Adar Ayer is Director of Programs at Associated Black Charities and one of the driving forces behind Baltimore Racial Justice Action. Amy Traub is the Associate Director of Policy and Research for Demos. That's a public policy organization. She's the lead author of their latest report, The Asset Value of Whiteness, Understanding the Racial Wealth Gap. We'll have links to the reports that we talked about and more information on the web. You can come to WIPR.org/midday. One quick note before we take a break. Coming up on the program tomorrow, I'll talk with Pakistani-born author Mohsen Hamid about his new novel, Exit West. It's set against the backdrop of today's real-life immigration crisis. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the new theater and the new production at Baltimore Center Stage. We'll talk about The White Snake tomorrow right here on Midday. Lunch for our midday guests was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches.